All right, welcome in to the Fan Pregame. It might be the slowest day on the sports calendar. We got a busy show.
Might be.
On the Fan Pregame tonight. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff. Let me just run it down for you. A five-pack of guests.
Oh.
Kurt Harnett, former Olympian, talk about the headspace of an Olympian a week away, 10 days away from the Olympic Games. Adam Stanley, ahead of the 152nd Open Championship, will begin in the wee hours.
That's two
tonight.
Pretty big events so far. Yeah.
We're starting hot. Bob Nightingale, USA Today, talk about what the Blue Jays are up to, because that's a daily checkpoint for the Fan Pregame at this point. David Alter to do a little Leafs, and Christine Brennan in about 10 minutes from USA Today to talk about Caitlin Clark, the WNBA.
Loaded.
And the Olympics as well. We'll talk about Caitlin Clark, because Caitlin Clark on our network tonight with a very, very, open space. Clear the floor for Caitlin Clark and the Indiana Fever tonight on Sportsnet 1. But July 17th, Jesse, was once a day that was circled on the calendar.
Really?
Nothing from the big four sports, of course.
Don't tell me it's your birthday or something.
No.
I've been sitting beside you for hours.
That's definitely not the case. I would not be calling attention to that. But it was supposed to be Leo Messi versus TFC in Miami.
Yeah.
But still, Messi, TFC was something that we were circling when we got a release of the MLS schedule just the second time. But, of course, we didn't really think about the Copa America and the fact that Leo Messi was not playing against TFC regardless, and won't be tonight because of the situation. Played a competitive soccer game just 4 days ago. But since we've been distracted by soccer, I just want to lay out what's happened here with TFC very quickly. 4 points from 8 MLS matches. This is since June 1.
Yeah, that's not great.
A loss in the Canadian Championship to Forge FC, which plays in the CPL, fired its president, Bill Manning, and they have dropped to 8th in the Eastern Conference, just 6 points out of last. All the other soccer going on has taken away a lot of the negativity that is swirling around TFC, and I guess that's one more for Jesse Marsh over John Herdman.
Well, I guess they'll be looking forward to the return of Osorio and Larea tonight, because they need all the help that they can get. Yeah, it is really a bummer about Messi, but the second you saw the shot of his ankle, you knew that there was no chance that he was playing whatsoever. I wouldn't be surprised if he doesn't play for a while, a couple of games. That thing was gnarly. I don't know if there's any structural damage. I haven't seen anything about that yet. But yeah, TFC's going to be in tough to hold on to their playoff spot the way that they're playing at the moment. Like that's not a very good run at the moment, and they got teams chasing them. And when you get 4 points from 8 MLS matches and go 9 games winless, do you really deserve to be a playoff team at this stage? Like, they're going to have to really turn it around quick.
Yeah, they will. And more attention will be on them as the summer goes on here, so we can judge them as we see them beginning tonight versus Inter Miami. But, there are other events coming on. I mentioned Caitlin Clark. We'll talk about the Indiana Fever in about 10 minutes with Christine Brennan. But the Open Championship begins in a few hours.
Can't wait.
I can't wait. Like, of course, when the major rolls around is exciting. But that this is the last major of
disgusting.
The year already bothers me to no end.
It's disgusting.
Like, it's like, again, when it comes up, the PGA Championship in its new slot, I'm like, yeah, PGA Championship, Major Championship Golf, I'm excited. But having it be the last in mid-July is a bummer to me. Like, the last major championship of the calendar year should be in August for me. I'm not going to get fired up about the FedEx Cup playoffs and all the money that's going to be given out as we close the summer. But it just rubs me the wrong way that the Open Championship, being the last of the year, is happening this early.
It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, the golf season, we are dead smack in the middle of the golf season. We are dead smack in the middle of summer. After this weekend, we are finished the majors in golf. And I understand the reasoning behind it. They want all of the attention in August and September to be paid towards the FedEx Cup. But here's the major issue that has been uncovered in the last couple of years with that. The PGA Tour is not what it once was because of those who have defected to live. And at one time, it was truly all the best players in the world playing in the FedEx Cup. And that was really cool. That was a lot of fun. Wasn't quite as good as majors, in my opinion, and probably most people's opinions. Mm-hmm. I don't really care if they play for $1 billion at the end of the FedEx Cup. It doesn't really mean much to me. It's not me cashing that money into my account, so I don't really care about that. I care about the prestige of the majors.
Sure.
But now with all the live guys having gone, you get down to those whittled down fields of even 80 tour championships, 30. Like, there are still going to be guys in there that you don't think either A, truly deserved to be there if they weren't, if the LIV guys hadn't left.
Mm-hmm.
And guys, you still, even if you follow golf like semi-casually, you might not know, which is not a good thing for the PGA Tour. So I think spacing it out a little bit more and just having it reflect the summer months and truly when the average person is golfing, which is literally you're in like mid-golf season right now, I think it would suit the PGA Tour a lot better.
It's funny because in pretty much every sport, dominance sells, dominance plays. You want that. It's kind of what gives you the platform to elevate your sport to the next level. I mean, not that the NBA really needed it, but the Golden State Warriors kind of brought in more casuals, gave more attention because they were historically good. Scottie Scheffler's on a historically good run, but I don't even know if it's the best thing for golf right now that Scottie has done what he's done this year. Now he's slowed down a little bit, but with the defectors, as you mentioned, there are fewer golfers that when on their A game can even hang with Scottie Scheffler when he's on his B game,
on
right?
Tour. Yeah.
And if they were all, and this is going to be maybe the strongest field of the entire year because a lot of LIV golfers will be allowed to play and there is less fringe than other majors, which allow more, not hanger on, but those who not necessarily grinding on the PGA Tour and winning a lot of money and giving a challenge to the likes of Scottie Scheffler. But, you know, we've gotten to the situation where Scheffler, A game, great. You want the guy who's the best in the world and went on his A game to win. But if even if he's kind of A-minus Scheffler and there's not enough golfers to actually challenge, I think there's a problem there. And this weekend could be different because, Brooks Koepka A-game can hang with Scottie Scheffler any day. Bryson DeChambeau has obviously proved that already this season, winning the U.S. Open. It is taken away something from golf, A, because it's a diluted field, but B, because there is this one great golfer who's making it more difficult on anyone else to have that success, to have that shine, to have their moment themselves. So golf's in a weird spot right now, but maybe for this weekend, we can set all that aside and stage a good golf tournament. But again, with the Open Championship, that is often weather permitting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I'm excited to again see some links golf. I know that this course in particular, Troon, is not the linksiest of links golfs because the greens are smaller. They have the postage stamp, of course, which is a tiny par three, absolutely tiny green, 120 yards. Going to be a lot of fun. Obviously, everyone's still excited to see what Tiger is going to bring to the table. But you're right. I mean, Scotty is so good that, you know, I would never put an asterisk beside his dominance because he's still playing against most of the best players in the world. And I love what Scottie Scheffler is doing. But you can't deny anymore that LIV has diluted the field in the PGA Tour. And now you have Bryson DeChambeau, who at one point was considered, you know, maybe one of the top three villains on the PGA Tour, and then when he left for LIV, still one of the top three villains in golf. Nobody has turned it around from a PR perspective like Bryson DeChambeau. And now you only really get to see him unless you're watching LIV on YouTube or whatever it is. You're only getting to see him at the majors or on his YouTube channel, which is good for him and credit to him that people are following him through YouTube and his own channel. But I want to see him every week.
Yeah.
And not only do I want to see him because I have the choice to, I can watch LIV if I want, but I want to see him against the best. And anyone that says that, like, this stuff doesn't matter, of course it matters. Like, are you really watching the PGA Tour with the same intensity that if all these guys were still going to be there? The answer for me is absolutely not. I would appreciate to have them all together much more often. And I know that we've gotten to the point where they were supposed to have some sort of a deal, really. We heard, like, inklings of it, and we haven't heard anything in a long time.
Yeah, it's been quiet.
It has been really quiet. But it needs to happen sooner rather than later because I do think as popular as golf has become really since the pandemic, it's had a bit of a boom. You got to get the band back together so we can have some great golf again.
The band will be back together this weekend. Yeah. 152nd Open Championship. We'll have Adam Stanley on in about an hour to discuss. We got about a minute here. MLB All-Star Game was last night. Shohei Ohtani did Shohei Ohtani things, meaning he had a great individual moment and his team lost. Jarren Duran wins the MVP with a go-ahead.
The Dodgers are good now.
Home run. The Dodgers are good, but they're not as good as they were expected to be. Do you have any? It was kind of like a blink and you miss Paul Skeens thing.
Oh, 100%.
I wasn't in my seat quick enough, and I really didn't see the story of the entire MLB All-Star Game leading in, which was Paul Skeens. I didn't mind the jerseys. A lot of people hated them.
They were great. They're sick.
I think my biggest concern was I don't need a pitch clock for the All-Star Game. I need more time to tell the stories of these players.
I'm with you.
Because it felt like it ended so quickly, And I didn't get my fix of, hey, what's going on with this random team and this random player in the National League?
Yeah, well, especially with the pitchers being as dominant as they've been the last little while, even going up against the best hitters in the world. Like, these are quick at bats. Everyone comes out throwing 100 miles an hour. It's like, okay, the guy threw four pitches to every batter and the inning's over. It's like, well, no, kind of want to appreciate seeing the best of the best go up against each other. So I'm with you on that. And Paul Skeens, it absolutely was a blink and he's done situation. Like, I was watching and, like everybody else, praying for him to walk Soto so that he can face Judge. And then Judge comes up, and it's like the second pitch, he just grounds out. And
I literally missed it. Put my phone down. Wow. And then saw the ground. I'm like, all right. Yeah. Okay. That was a lot of talk for very little substance.
Exactly.
Okay, let's switch gears here. The WNBA has a moment tonight with all four major American professional sports leagues not having any action, which is a rarity, but the WNBA steps up. Christine Brennan is a national columnist for USA Today, done great work covering the WNBA this season, and she joins us now. Christine, I feel like this is just another example of the WNBA seizing and understanding the moment, scheduling Caitlin Clark on a night like tonight. Just another example for you as well?
Oh, without a doubt, guys. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me. And for sure. You know, these are these kind of strange few days in the sports calendar where nothing's happening on the men's side, but certainly there's a lot happening in women's basketball and Caitlin Clark. I mean, she truly is a phenomenon the likes of which we have never seen in women's sports. And it's not just women's basketball because, of course, Serena Williams, of course, the U.S. women's soccer team in 1999 just celebrated that 25th anniversary. But this is sustaining itself day in, day out, week in, week out. Every time Caitlin Clark and Indiana play, they have TV ratings that are above anything that has happened in the WNBA in decades. The attendance on the road, at home, sellouts. She's the only one, the Indiana Fever, they're the only ones doing that. And she's playing great. You know, they were early on, all those naysayers, oh, she's going to have a tough time. You know, Diana Taurasi, reality is coming. Yeah, reality, I think, just came and went. Or maybe Taurasi meant reality for the WNBA. Because last I looked, Caitlin Clark is in the top 20 of all five big offensive categories, well, including rebounds. But assists, points, steals, blocks, and rebounds. Mm-hmm. And there's only two other players that were in the top 20, and that was Nafisa Collier and Brianna Stewart, and Caitlin Clark, the rookie. Extraordinary. And in most of those categories, she's way at the top or closer to the top, in the top 15. And at assists, she's number one in the league. Number one in the league in assists. This rookie that people said was going to have a tough time handling the WNBA. And, of course, the last thing about Clark, just handling it beautifully, all the attention, the negativity, the controversy, the cheap shot from Kennedy Carter, and absolutely just a role model for the ages in terms of how she's handled herself. So lots to talk about and lots to watch tonight. You're right.
Christine, it feels like looking back now, the success of the WNBA was almost obvious. Like, I don't think that's revisionist history. If you're looking for places in sport with which can grow, the WNBA was a product that was very good in its own right, and maybe they just needed a star or a couple of stars to come around and push it to the next level. But how big, when you look at the WNBA now with 12 teams, and there's going to be an expansion team here in Toronto in a couple of years, how big can the WNBA get? Like, are they eventually going to try and match the number of teams in the WNBA 10, 15 years down the road? Or is it just like sort of a, how can we make this level sustainable for the next number of years first?
Yeah, you know, I think I don't know that equality with the NBA, which isn't happening right now and may never in terms of number of teams and, of course, all the other very important markers and factors, which would be things like the ratings, TV ratings, attendance for the entire league. Of course, the TV deal, which there is obviously news on that front, and salaries. You know, the WNBA is nowhere near. Caitlin Clark is making millions. What was that, a $28 million, I think, Nike shoe deal? So she's, you know, she is making just extraordinary money, well-deserved, every little bit of it in terms of what she's doing. But a lot of the players are not. And the salaries, as we know, are paltry compared to the NBA. But I think they're moving, clearly they're moving in the right direction. That is not a newsflash. That is a fact. You know, they're really, we know it. You can see it. You can see what's happening. The revenue alone for TV, the next market, the next broadcast rights deal, instead of being about $50 million a year that the WNBA is getting, you know, just a paltry sum compared to the NBA, it looks like it's going to be, the revenue will surge up to $200 million a year from the broadcast rights. So, you know, that they were hoping to maybe double it. So that looks like four times. We'll see how it all plays out. But that's great. So I think, as is the case with Title IX, the law signed by Richard Nixon in June of 72, 52 years ago, opening the floodgates for girls and women to play sports in the United States, obviously, you know, seriously, that mindset has always been a part of North American sports and the Olympic successes of women across the U.S., Canada, you know, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is great. And it's all, for me, it's always been, you know, that let's, you know, keep moving forward, you know, just keep doing better and having things continue to grow so that young women who want to play sports can, and moms and dads can encourage their daughters, just like their sons. So many things about it that weren't happening a generation or two ago. And now it is happening, and that is the celebration. And to me, that is the victory.
So it's not a normal season by which Caitlin Clark is debuting. We have this month-long Olympic break, and that means it's the 26th game already for Caitlin Clark tonight against the Dallas Wings, which is maybe the most impressive thing about all of this is that she's had to play so much basketball under so much scrutiny. And yeah. I know you gushed about Caitlin Clark in your first answer with us, but what is the thing on the basketball court, in uniform, whatever it must be, that would be considered her greatest success to this point? Is it dealing with all the noise around her? Is it the statistical categories that she's filling up? Is it just surviving the rigors of 26 games in less than 2 months? Like, what is the thing that has you marveling the most?
You know, I think maybe all of it. And truly, it's, you know, we knew she was a great basketball player and she was incredibly entertaining. You know, you don't want to take your eyes off of her because when she's bringing that ball up the floor, she could be firing a three from anywhere, the logo threes that we've heard so much about. And that's why this is crossed over from sports fans into, you know, grandma and grandpa making sure they know what channel, you know, the game is on, like tonight, the way that they used would have done when Tiger Woods was in his heyday, and they made sure their Sunday afternoons were free for Tiger's tea time at the Masters or U.S. Open or wherever. And, you know, that's a pretty, pretty important and significant, I think, kind of, well, thought, but also a chunk of the American and worldwide population, the sense that people who really don't care about sports care about this. And that is the parallel. Caitlin Clark, Tiger Woods, obviously, over the Michael Jordan. Again, I'd say Serena Williams at times. Certainly, there have been other, Wayne Gretzky, right? Where you didn't have to be a sports fan to want to watch or care. And I've certainly missed some people. That's just a couple off the top of my head. But Caitlin is that. And it's, well, the team sport athlete as a woman, you know, women's team sport, that's never happened before. Mm-hmm. As I said, Serena, you know, maybe Chris Evert, Martina, those days. But that was tennis. That wasn't a team sport. And so I think that makes it so significant. But she truly is the high wire act at the circus. And you can watch her. You know, rebounding is important. I played basketball. I'm almost 6 feet tall. I get, you know, being down there and throwing your elbows. That's a huge part of the game. But if you're new to the game, you know, if you don't watch a lot of basketball or sports, well, that's about five or six bodies down there into the basket, right, that are just kind of moving around. It's a big scrum, and it's a little hard to pick people out or to see. Again, not basketball fans, but your average person that wants, which is, of course, what we're talking about here with the incredible interest in Caitlin Clark and the WNBA. Well, Caitlin's not doing that. Caitlin Clark is the one bringing the ball down the floor by herself or being face guarded as she has been. And of course, surviving and thriving in that world of that incredible defense they've thrown at her. Another huge point to answer your question. But she's coming down the court by herself or someone's near her. You've got 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 seconds you're only watching her. So she is the star of the show. She is the Broadway star that has just come on the stage. And now, okay, she's heaving it from the logo, and it's in, 3 points. Or beautiful pass. That's the other thing. The passing is extraordinary, hence her lead in the assists in the WNBA, which I think will only grow that over the next the rest of the season, just because, you know, she's been averaging, I think, 9 or 10 assists the last 5 or 6 games, much better than her early games, which were so tough against very, very tough teams in that ridiculous stretch of 11 games in 20 days, where it's almost like the league, they wanted to, like, kill her. I mean, they didn't want to kill her, but you know what I mean? And she did survive that. And I think maybe in addition to what she brings to the casual fan or the person who's not the fan at all, that you know, high wire act, as I mentioned, where you can just enjoy it and revel in it as you watch it, and so visible and so easy to understand. But you also then had the schedule, which made no sense. Why the WNBA didn't pluck one of those Connecticut or New York games and move it into September, I have no idea. And yet, the Indiana Fever, worst team, obviously, in the league because they had the top draft pick, they and Caitlin Clark survived and got better. They had no time to practice. They lost a lot of those games. And now they're 6-4 over their last 10 games. I think they were 8-4 overall in 12 games. They're winning. They're in the playoffs if the season ends today. They actually have a nice margin to be in the playoffs, several game lead over the 4 teams that wouldn't make it. And again, surviving and thriving, and then Caitlin getting so good so quickly. That's the other thing. The naysayers. I mean, she is one of the best players in the league right now. That's not a gift. That's not that's not hyperbole. She's that good. She's that strong. And again, she's only going to get better, because if this is kind of still learning, what is really good going to be? Because she really is good, really good right now.
Yeah, you mentioned her surviving, and I believe Caitlin when she says that she's looking forward to the Olympic break to maybe get some time to relax the body. But when you look at the decision to not have her on the U.S. Olympic team, do you think it was something that was maybe a little bit short-sighted, considering the popularity that and eyeballs that she would have brought to that program? Or do they just not need her? They're probably going to roll to an 8th straight gold medal. What did you make of that decision to leave Caitlin off that team?
You said, you know, short-sighted, and I will say this. Yes, times 100. I called it the worst. I've seen a lot of dumb decisions and a lot of bad things, you know, happen involving players and teams and selections and all that. I'm not talking, of course, about the horrors of sex abuse and all of that in gymnastics within the Olympic world. I've covered the Olympics since L.A. in 84. So that's 40 years. I started in kindergarten. So all joking aside, I've seen a lot. And in terms of a player decision, you know, selection decision, team selection decision is the worst I have ever seen by a lot. It's over a month ago. I was able to break the news that she wasn't on the team. And it remains absolutely stunning to me that USA Basketball made that decision. From what I understand, obviously NBC is not happy. I mean, what they could have done with her and this interest and worldwide, not just NBC, but any of the rights holders around the world, because there's such interest in Caitlin Clark and this American phenom. Who is she, right? I could have seen, you know, Bulgarians and Italians running, you know, to get to the first game just because you want to see her, even if she's playing 5 minutes at the end of the game. And that's all gone. Think of the worldwide sales of her jersey with USA on it. Oh, my gosh. And the money that then could have been pumped back into USA Basketball. It is a devastating mistake. It remains a terrible mistake. I get all the arguments. Maybe someone's listening right now saying, well, who would you take off? Who would you take off? I get it. It is the greatest team in sports. They have not lost since 1992. They're going to win almost for sure this next gold medal, even if the three of us were the 10th, 11th, and 12th people on the team. Seriously, they're that good.
Yeah.
But you have to understand that women's sports are not equal to men's, and this was the moment, and they missed it. They blew it. And, I think it will go down in history as one of the worst decisions ever, for sure.
Yeah, I wasn't so sure, but you laid it out perfectly there. I mean, I thought one of the most important things would have been, hey, you can kind of cool everyone down if they're teammates, right? Like if she is amongst the best and she has an opportunity to mix and mingle with the other great players in the WNBA, then all this weird vitriolic nature that's been surrounding her and on court may settle down and it might be good for everyone. But that's just one of many reasons why she should have been there, right, Christine?
Oh, well, without a doubt. And by the way, those things, you know, Diana Taurasi, who was quite snippy and an undercurrent of jealousy or whatever, back in the Women's Final Four, Diana Taurasi said great things about her and gave her a big hug when they played. And they played now, Caitlin's played Taurasi's team twice, beaten it. One time Taurasi did not play because of, you know, injury or concern or whatever a couple weeks ago. But Clark and Indiana are 2-0 against Taurasi in Phoenix. How about that? Mm-hmm. If that doesn't get your attention. So I guess she's playing pretty well, huh? Maybe she can, again, the reality. I think you know, Caitlin's handling the reality so well. But bottom line is, yeah, they Taurasi's been married. Brittany Griner, big hug. I do think some of them, and maybe hopefully a lot of them, have gotten the idea, hey, listen, this is the best thing that could ever happen for you. And that's what happened with men's golf and Tiger. Within a week or two, they're like, hey, this is great. A rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah.
We love you, Tiger. Obviously, golf is individual, basketball, team sport, different. But yes, it has been, it hasn't been good for those who seem to be reluctant to accept the fact that Caitlin Clark is the one selling out, Caitlin in Indiana. It is happening, and you don't start naming the entire rookie class. Angel Reese is great. There's others who are great. Cam Brink had a great start to the season, but they're not Caitlin Clark. Caitlin Clark is alone in terms of this incredible star power that supersedes basketball and supersedes women's sports. And that is something that there's still, you'll hear people say, talk about Caitlin and then, yeah, well, Caitlin and Angel. No, again, Angel's great. She's a great basketball player and deserves all any kudos and headlines she gets. But in terms of, you know, selling arenas out, Angel was in D.C. here where I am on one night, and they Chicago and played Washington, and it was about 10,000, exactly 10,000. Same arena, 24 hours later, Caitlin Clark in Indiana, over 20,000, the biggest crowd in WNBA history since, I believe it was 2006 or 7. And so that's apples to apples. You know, double the crowd, and the TV ratings are the same. And so it is Caitlin Clark, and I think now it seems like most of the league is starting to get it and is appreciative, although the Olympic basketball coach, Cheryl Reeve, just people can look it up and Google my stories. Some really interesting tweets singling out 22-year-old Caitlin Clark on May 3rd. This is the Olympic basketball coach while Caitlin was in the pool to maybe be selected. A 57-year-old coach singling out a 22-year-old on Twitter, May 3rd. Again, I've written all about it. And then Cheryl Reeve the other day was asked about the fact that Indiana was coming to Minnesota and how about the fact that most of the fans would be for Indiana because Iowa is so close to Minnesota. And, in fact, that's where Caitlin would go. Her dad, mom, or whatever, would take her for WNBA games to watch when she was a girl up to Minneapolis from Iowa, not far at all. And Cheryl Reeve asked about this phenomenon. She said, I don't give two blanks and or one blank. And it starts with an S. Mm. That's the Olympic coach, the U.S. Olympic coach. My goodness. So she seems to not be handling it particularly well. I've tried 5, 6, 7 times, texting, calling, leaving messages, working through the PR people to see if she would speak to me about both of these things back in May and now the thing the other day. And she won't.
It's weird.
Yeah.
So clearly she has some issues. And, you know, I'll be in Paris and I will certainly stay on it. I promise you that.
There you go. And we'll be reading for sure. It is sad, but it feels like progress has been made. I mean, Caitlin initiated some of this progress, and progress since she arrived on the scene feels like it is definitely happening. We appreciate your time here tonight. Christine, enjoy another Olympics. And, yeah, we'll be reading you on Caitlin Clark and otherwise.
Oh, thanks so much. I always love talking to you. And, call during the Olympics. If we've got a few minutes, let's get it done.
There you go. We'll do it.
Thanks, Christine.
Thanks, Christine. That's Christine Brennan of USA Today covering all the Olympics. That's pretty impressive. Also for ABC and CNN, just a reminder, Fever and Dallas Wings, Indiana Fever, Dallas Wings on Sportsnet 1 tonight. So we do have a big game on the network. Let's take a break.
Sure.
We're going to
talk
to a big guest, an Olympian or a former Olympian and former chef de mission. I'm not good at saying that. You're going to have to help me out because you, like Christine, are going to Paris.
I don't know how to say it yet. Chef de mission.
We'll work on it. Maybe he'll say it for us. Kurt Harnett after the break on the Fan Pregame.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back on the Fan Pregame. It's Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff. The Olympics in Paris are 9 days away. And I feel like this would be, if you're an Olympic athlete, the absolute worst time. Because you're just thinking about it. Like, hay's in the barn.
Like, how do you sleep?
The work's done.
Yeah.
How do you sleep? How do you deal with the nerves? How do you deal with the mentality piece? How do you prepare yourself when all you got to do is wait?
I mean, I'm going to work and I can't sleep.
That's true.
I don't like
That's
to true. Fly.
Some people, though, no. are built different. And our next guest, I think, was. Kurt Harnett is a 3-time Olympic medalist, Canadian Sports Hall of Famer, the chef de mission. I think I said that right for Canada
in
the 2016 Olympics. And he joins us now with single digit days to go. Kurt, how are you? Thanks for jumping on with us.
Hey, man, I'm on the edge of my seat about you guys. I mean, hey, going into work every day. It was great to open it. Jesse, Justin, thanks for having me on and, you know, getting the chance to chat about this. I mean, it is an exciting time, right? It's like, you know, walking on hot coals or putting a hot water on a hot pan, all that kind of stuff, the way that it goes. But a really, really exciting time. But, you know, an athlete's going in, you know, they know that they're prepared, but there's still fine tuning happening. And that may even be athletes going over to start acclimatize to the time change, get, you know, used to the environment. There's still work to be done.
What was it like for you personally? I know, because you've been, you know, so many times, 3-time Olympic medalist. Like, what were these moments like specifically for you? And then when you get there, like, what is the preparation? How do you sleep before events? Because I imagine, you know, any athlete before a big game, whether it's a playoff game or whatever it may be, there's stress that's involved. But Olympics is a bit different because only comes around once every 4 years. So the spotlight is on you for such a short amount of time that the pressure is, I think, even more than any other sport outside of the Olympics that people play. So what is that feeling like? Because I would imagine that could be quite difficult to get a handle on.
Yeah, lucky had the chance to have a few experiences with that. But it's, you know, there's a trust in the process. And that's sometimes where anxieties and stress and pressure points come in, is where maybe you're not feeling like you're prepared. And there are circumstances that could make that happen that were outside the athlete's control, or, you know, they had an accident or they got sick or something to that effect. But, you know, it's, you know, the blinders are on when you're going through on this journey. Like, you're just so focused in. And, you know, if you've got a great team around you, coaching staff, all that kind of stuff, that you've probably gone through a series of either trial runs or, you know, all that stuff to make it as familiar as possible. And that, I think, is just really trusting the process. It comes down to anything. And, you know, as an athlete, I did sleep well at night when I knew that I had done everything that I could. Mm. And it was just up to the competition, up to the day, you know, the next day to unfold. So sure, there's some maybe that are newer to this or some that are just naturally get stressed out, it's personalities. It's all of those things that make us human and, you know, different is all of those pieces. So yeah, man, there's no doubt that there's excitement and anticipation. And, you know, prior to the Rio Olympics, 2016, of course, getting to be part of the team behind the team. So getting to witness and see and feel it just from a completely different perspective. There's no more, you know, energetic time that I've ever been or environment than I've been than the night before the opening ceremonies, like just before the games begin, because there's 10,000 dreams in that village that have yet to be realized, right? The games really haven't started. And so like that, what if the anticipation of what can be is really, really palatable and really amazing. I recommend that experience to anybody.
Yeah, I'd like that experience. How many hats did you wear not like physical real hats. Like how many
hats do you wear as a chef de mission?
I wouldn't put any hats on that hair personally if it were me. But when you were the chef de mission, like how many jobs do you have? Like, is it therapist? Is it strength coach? Like, how many things rolled up under your banner, or were you just like, what? Just you tell us. I won't put it on. I won't say it myself. What were your roles there?
The chef de mission is the lead delegate for the entire Canadian team at the Olympic Games. So effectively all communications, all aspects of running the team and quite frankly, the organization, the organizers of the games communicate through the chef de mission. So it's a pretty big role, but what Canada does so well is that they nominate or they put in that position an athlete that's been through it before and has tons of experience and has this ability to act, quite frankly, as a mentor, as a cheerleader, as a leader to the athletes and the team that's on the ground. Again, the team behind the team to sort of bring perspective to all elements. And Canada is one of the few countries that does that. The chef de mission for some other country is a fully administrative role. Right, that is overseeing accommodations, transportation, food and beverage, all the security issues, all of that kind of stuff. So it's a really interesting role. It's an amazing honor to play it, to be a part of it. I've been one of many, and Mark Tewksbury, myself, Marnie McBean, Bernie Surin is the chef in Paris, an amazing leader. These athletes have it right. But Canada is like the professionals of the team behind the team are world class. They are best in the jobs that they do, overseeing all of the levers that it takes to manage the team on the ground, and really leaves it in the hands of the athlete just to do their job, right? To ensure, those people are making sure those athletes have everything that they need to compete and win against the best in the world. And that's all that they have to worry about. And that's what an athlete needs to do going into these Olympic Games, is only concern themselves with their task, with what their job is, and not concern themselves with those levers and those variables that, quite frankly, they don't have control over.
Yeah, I mean, first time I heard Chef de Mission, I was like, wow, it's one person cooks for the entire delegation. It's just very, very impressive. I understand that your story falling into cycling was a pretty unbelievable one and involved you playing hockey and then realizing that cycling was the path that you wanted to go down. But maybe you can outline and be a little bit more specific about how you eventually got into cycling and it led you to obviously three Olympic medals.
Yeah, the journey is what every kid from Thunder Bay probably falls on. Mm-hmm. I wanted to play in the NHL. I wanted to be Yvon Cornoyer is what I wanted. And, but I also played a lot of other sports. And when I made the transition from grade school into high school, I joined the high school football team. And, I was one of the football players that never left the field. Like I was the center on offense and I was the defensive end on defense. And the thing that happened that if there was a hockey practice and a football game that so it coincided, I was, of course, at that hockey practice, right? I wanted to be an NHL player. And as you would know, if you're missing practices at hockey, you're not getting the time on the ice that you deserve. So my football coach, who was also my sheet metal and drafting teacher at school, the assistant head of, the phys ed department at Hammarskjöld High School in Thunder Bay, but he was also the president of the Thunder Bay Cycling Club. He was an assistant coach at Lakehead Wrestling for Lakehead University's wrestling team. This guy, Harry Curtis was his name, did it all. And he pulled me aside and he says, like, I recognize that this hockey thing is really, really important for you. I've got the perfect way for you to stay in shape during the summer months. So he introduced me to cycling. He was bringing cycling into the community, into the school systems. It was just leading up to when Thunder Bay was hosting the Canada Summer Games. So there was big push with the clubs in the community to activate, kids in the community, brings awareness to the Canada Summer Games, all that sort of stuff. So I showed up at my first cycling practice at Hammarskjöld High School I used to race motocross. I sold the motorbike because I had a bad season, but my cutoff motorcycle gloves. Like I think it was a Jofa, you know, hockey helmet on, gym shorts on, and a borrowed DCM Targa that was two sizes too big for me. And I went on that summer to win the Thunder Bay cycling, the high school cycling championships for Thunder Bay. So the journey just kind of went. I still wanted to be that NHL player. Like I still wanted that. And of course I'd show up to training camp in September, skating circles around all my teammates. Right. Mm-hmm. Of course, with these funny tan lines and shaved legs, but still, you know, I got drafted London Knights, at the time that the London Knights were not necessarily at the top of the league. I had just won. That was in 82. I had just won the junior national champions championships in Edmonton, Alberta, on the road and on the track. And I just showed up at training camp in London, just realizing that hockey wasn't in my future, that I wasn't going to do that. I made it to the final cut. Coach pulled me aside. They wanted to send me to Richmond Hill to their junior B team or go back to Thunder Bay and play juvenile hockey. And I said, you know what, how about option number three? And they said, what's that? And I said, I'm going to try the cycling thing out. Just started committing full time. Again, that was in the early or late summer of 1982. A year and a half later or 2 years later, I'm standing on Olympic podium in Los Angeles, California, getting a silver medal around my neck in cycling. So it was this amazing journey, just testing it out, figuring it out step by step. When I decided to make or invest full time into cycling, it wasn't, hey, let's go to the Olympics. It was just like, hey, let's see where this can go. So yeah, it was a fun journey. And, you know, there's a lot of cyclists out there athletes that find second careers. They play sports, play soccer, they play hockey, basketball or other sports. And one, we have a couple of great examples in that entered into this Olympic Games is in Kelsey Mitchell, who's the defending gold medal champion from Tokyo in 2021. Kelsey started out as a soccer player, came in to cycling through RBC training ground. And, 5 years later went and won a gold medal at the Olympic Games in cycling. So, We see that a lot, especially on the track side in velodrome cycling and the type of cycling that I did.
So you got this incredible advice at a pretty important time in your life, right? And you get to do this and you fall in love with it and it takes you all these great places. So now it's your turn, I suppose, to give advice. What sort of wisdom do you impart on those who have more common dreams, which is maybe hockey or soccer or whatever? How do you involve yourself and what do you say when people are looking for the wisdom that you received when you needed it?
That's a really awesome question, because sometimes you get cornered by parents that are like, I want my daughter to, be this great athlete. And how do I, they tend to narrow focus down. And it's like, it's really critical for an athlete to have fun. And let's just call it that. Like, you got to be invested in and enjoying yourself. Sure, there's going to be bad days or hard days, but you got to be having a great time and doing something that you're really, really passionate about. And, it's taking it for what it is, enjoying the journey, the process, and seeing where it takes you. And again, the bicycle gave me tremendous opportunity. It took me around the world. I got to see the world, as they say, by the seat of my pants, right? And who would have thought, how many years ago I never would have thought of that when I was 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. I love to ride my bike all the time, but at the age of 12, 13, I would have never thought I would be who I am to have gotten the chance to do what I do and be sitting here talking to you guys today, right? Like, it's an amazing journey, and you have to embrace all of the ups and downs, hills and dales and valleys, and, all the challenges that come with it. Enjoy that. And, again, like with the athletes going to the Olympics, control what you can control. The other stuff you have to is just static. And you're there for a reason. You're there because you've earned it. You deserve it. And let's, take the weight of what the situation is or the environment is and see what you can do, see what the potential is. And I think that's sometimes we opened up the conversation with that, right? Like, oh my God, the pressure of the moment and all that stuff.
Yeah.
No, man. Like, be there, enjoy it, embrace it, go with it, and see where you can take it.
I imagine you're partial to watching cycling at the Olympics, but is there any other event that you get up for that you're really excited to see every time the Summer Olympics roll around?
It's one of the blessings on the journey that I've had. Of course, when I got involved, I was the chef de mission for the Pan Am Games team in 2015. I got the opportunity to take that over to 2016 in Rio. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of sports that sometimes I think we just kind of, you know, push aside and just say, it's not hockey, I don't care about it.
Sure.
And if you really gave it the time, I believe you'd be kind of blown away by it. And I've had that opportunity to sit beside some experts, because yes, it does take some time and energy to learn a little bit about the technical aspects of the sport. But fencing, I'm blown away by fencing. Rugby sevens, unbelievable. Indoor volleyball, probably no more powerful, faster indoor sport in the team sport in the world. Like it's mind-boggling, right? Like to see it, to watch it. Then we've got our basketball teams. We've got the swimming. Like, come on, track and field. Give me a break, right? Like, the list goes on and on and on. You know, like, I don't know. Our synchronized swimmers, like the power that it takes. You know, we sort of, you know, there's been comedy shows or comedy skits done on synchronized swim for years and years and years. But if you pay attention to what it takes for them to hold their breath for 5 minutes and do what they're doing underwater, yeah, you're going like, come on, right? So I don't mean to be, I'm getting a little excited about it because it is. It is just fascinating for me. And Rob Rusnov, 1996, I'm walking down the hallway in the Olympic Village. Doors are open, you know, there's athletes, and I'm going to the physio room. And I see this guy sitting in his room, and he's got a weight scale, and he's an archer, right? And he's weighing like the tips and the tails of the arrow, and he's tweaking it. And I sat there for 25 minutes to understand what he was doing, because the technical element of it, like that arrow, and I can't remember what it was. It travels through the air like a sine wave, and it can't be perfectly balanced because that'll straighten it. Like, it was just fascinating to sit there for 25 minutes. I was late for my physio appointment while I'm, you know, racing off to challenge for an Olympic medal in the Atlanta Games. It was just, it just fascinated. The technical side of the sports, of all the sports, just fascinating.
That was the best chef de mission answer of all time. You didn't leave anything out.
I think that would be one of the coolest things about going to Olympics. And again, Jesse, I guess pressure's on here. Just get to see everyone doing their thing at the highest level and what it might look like behind the scenes. I'm sure you have countless stories about just encounters with athletes. And I want to get into those, but we can't today. We're going to have you on later because we do have to hit a break,
awesome.
Kurt. But we appreciate the time. And if you're able or you're willing, we'll call you again soon if that's okay.
Well, thanks for having me on, and hopefully, you know, we got to share some stories. I got a ton more.
There we go. Okay. All right. We're on the edge of our seat. We're ready for him, Kurt. That's Kurt Harnett, three-time Olympic medalist, Canadian Sports Hall of Famer, chef de mission.
That was epic.
Better at that. For the 2016 games in Rio, which were a wild game.
Yeah.
There are some stories there. Maybe a 2016 story from him. But when I think about pressure, and we got about a minute here, I think about Summer McIntosh. And she's 17 years old. Possibility to win three Olympic gold medals. Mm-hmm. Possibility of others as well in the pool this year. You're only 17. I don't know what you were doing at 17. I didn't have any pressure on me whatsoever. I think maybe, you know, being that young might help you because you don't understand the gravity of the moment, maybe as you would if you were 25. But boy, being 17 with that sort of responsibility hanging on you, couldn't imagine.
I have no idea how they do that. That's part of the allure of the Olympics. How do they possibly keep their wits about them? Like, I put me in under any kind of pressure, fold like a cheap suit. I would not be able to perform at the Olympics.
That's why we are sitting here.
Yeah,
Jesse.
Exactly.
That's
right.
Why we are sitting here. We got a busy final hour still to come on the Fan pregame. It is a 2-hour edition. Adam Stanley, Bob Nightingale, David Alter. Lots to get into. A busy day on the slowest day on the sports calendar. I love it. Fan pregame is back in a moment.